Today on Speaking Out of Place, we sit down with Peter Beinart to discuss his new book, Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza. We ask him what led him to write this intense and intensely provocative book, which declares that Jews, quote, need a new story, other than the current one, in which, Beinart argues, Jews see themselves as innocent with regard to the genocide in Gaza. I ask Peter to fully unpack this claim, quote, many Jews treat a Jewish state the way the Bible feared Jewish monarchs would treat themselves, as a higher power beholden to no external standard. Again and again, we are ordered to accept a Jewish state's quote-unquote right to exist. But the language is perverse. In Jewish tradition, states have no inherent value. States are not created in the image of God. Human beings are. States are mere instruments. The legitimacy of a Jewish state, like the holiness of the Jewish people, is conditional on how it behaves. It is subject to law, not a law in and of itself. We hope you enjoy this and other episodes. Please help support Speaking Out of Place by subscribing via our website, speakingoutofplace.com, following us on Instagram, and following me on Blue Sky. My handle is Palumbo Liu. You can give me your feedback and suggest people to invite and topics to cover. Speaking Out of Place is made with support from Stanford University. I alone am responsible for its content. Thank you so much, Peter, for being on the show. It's such an important book, and I'm delighted to be able to talk to you about it in detail. I was going to ask you to lay out the basic argument of the book. What are its most salient points that you want people to understand? You have this really powerful passage on page 9 that begins, this is about the story Jews tell ourselves to block out the screams. And I would love it if you would read that passage that continues on to the next page about this need for a new story. Could you do that, please?
Sure. This book is about the story Jews tell ourselves to block out the screams. It's about the story that enables our leaders, our families, and our friends to watch the destruction of the Gaza Strip, the flattening of universities, the people forced to make bread from hay, the children freezing to death under buildings turned to rubble by a state that speaks in our name, and shrug, if not applaud. It's about the story that convinces even Jews who are genuinely pained by Gaza's agony that there is no other way to keep us safe. It's our version of a story told in many variations by many peoples in many places who decide that protecting themselves requires subjugating others, that equality is tantamount to death. My hope is that we will one day see Gaza's obliteration as a turning point in Jewish history. From the destruction of the Second Temple to the expulsion from Spain to the Holocaust, Jews have told new stories to answer the horrors we endured. We must now tell a new story to answer the horror that a Jewish country has perpetrated with the support of many Jews around the world.
There's so much in that passage that informs the core of your book. You attach this story that Jews tell themselves to almost a universal story about how people protect themselves by creating this stark division between themselves and a perceived threat. You talk specifically about this destruction of Gaza. You've been writing about this subject, Israel-Palestine, for such a long time with increasing fervor. What was it about the war on Gaza that brought you to write this book?
It's interesting. There's a line that really impacted me by the late Israeli Orthodox social critic Yeshaya Halevavitz, who says at one point in his writing, he wrote this in the 70s, he says, when a state or a nation or a country is treated as an absolute value, anything goes. Perhaps to some degree, we're seeing some version of that in the United States with Donald Trump today, the kind of idolatry of the state. And I think I had an anxiety, a fear for a number of years now, that the relationship between the organized American Jewish community and Israel was such that anything goes, which to say that Israel could do things that were even far worse than the things that it had been doing. And there would be no mechanism in our discourse, in our institutions, in the Jewish community, and potentially in the U.S. government itself, to say enough. It stops here. We now oppose this. We will stop supporting this. And that was my fear before October 7th. And then after the horror of October 7th and Israel's assault on Gaza, I began to feel like that was playing out in front of me because the level of the horror was so extreme. And yet I found that people I knew, people who claimed leadership in Jewish spaces, were essentially relying on a set of storylines to explain what was happening that would allow them to essentially justify anything.
Yes, absolutely. I was thinking of the same thing, that people in the Jewish community that I work closely with seem to undergo this transformation, that they were no longer constrained by certain notions. And this event not just gave them a license, but almost the imperative to act beyond the kind of constraints that I was used to seeing them operate under. And I was struck by how your passion around the subject reveals itself in the language that you use. I don't know if you perceive this yourself, the author, but I found your rhetoric to be bracing, to say the least, but also very riveting. And in fact, the passage I was going to read connects very well with what you just said. You say, many Jews treat a Jewish state the way the Bible feared Jewish monarchs would treat themselves, as a higher power, beholden to no external standard. Again and again, we are ordered to accept a Jewish state's right to exist. But the language is perverse. In Jewish tradition, states have no inherent value. States are not created in the image of God. Human beings are. States are mere instruments. The legitimacy of a Jewish state, like the holiness of the Jewish people, is conditional on how it behaves. It is subject to law and not a law in and of itself. And I was struck by how throughout the book, you lean back on religious texts to provide precisely that kind of constraint on the unbridled behavior of states. Could you talk more about how you're using these texts as a powerful buttress to your argument?
Sure. And I should say, maybe it goes without saying, that others use these texts in different ways, right? Yeah. In any large religious tradition, there are multiple voices, and the creativity of Jewish interpretation, I imagine, like in any religious interpretation, has to do with the way in which one interprets different sacred texts and makes meaning from them. But for me, the one can't really escape, or I can't escape from, a very fundamental notion, which is that Torah doesn't start with Jews. Torah starts with universal human beings. The story, the drama of the Jewish people doesn't begin until a ways into the book of Genesis. So the first human beings that we encounter are universal human beings, Adam, Eve, Noah. They have no nation or tribe, really. And I think from this, you get this phrase that really resonated with me from Abraham Joshua Heschel in his famous speech that he gave in this, on the speech on religion and race in 1963, where he says that the only thing that's created in the image of God is the human being. He actually uses the word man, but I think today we would probably say person or human being, right? And so I think if you start with that, then you can see where Leibovitz, another figure who really influenced me, this Israeli Orthodox social critic, basically says that the value of a state can only be understood in relationship to the value of the human being. And if you see the state as having unconditional value, a value that's not judged against its impact on the human beings, then you're imagining that a state is created in the image of God rather than human beings are created in the image of God. And I think that is, in reality, the way a lot of kind of pro-Israel Jewish discourse, and friends that matter, pro-Israel non-Jewish Christian discourse operates, which is to say, yep, to enter into the conversation as a legitimate part of the conversation, you must first accept Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state. So that's unconditional. The lives of the people who live within this state, particularly the Palestinians, who make up 50% of the population under Israeli control, those are negotiable, right? Mm-hmm. They are not as important as the right of the state itself. And that, to me, feels like it fits with notions of idolatry, in which you imagine that anything, whether it's a stone, an idol, a tree, a star, or indeed a state, is more valuable than the human beings who are orbiting around it.
How did we get to this spot, Peter? How did we get to this position where the notions are completely inverted
there are different ways of thinking about this. To some degree, I think this is perhaps part of a larger story in the contemporary world in which we see the rise of ethno-nationalist movements that within various different traditions essentially swallow up the universalistic elements in those traditions, which emphasize the humanity, the dignity of all people, right? I'm not an expert on white evangelical Christians, but one of the things that I noticed as an observer is that even if one goes back to George W. Bush, who was obviously a deeply problematic president in a lot of ways, the way he expressed his Christianity had universalistic elements to it. He said, family values don't stop at the Rio Grande, right? He was eventually saying that people who lived on the other side of the U.S. border and wanted to come in without documentation were still human beings whose humanity we need to recognize. He actually expanded dramatically U.S. Money to fight AIDS because as a Christian, he believed that there were moral obligations to Christians or even non-Christians in Africa. So alien to the kind of Christianity, if we can call it that, that we see in Donald Trump's America, where essentially all that matters is the notion of the state, right? And the notion of Americans. And there's this zero moral obligation to feel solidarity with any other human being, right? I'm also not a scholar of Hinduism. You think about the way in which Narendra Modi has basically imposed Hindutva on Hinduism, right? So it's also now this notion that glorifies the ethno-state without obligations to Muslims and others who live within it. So there's a parallel thing, which I think has happened in Jewish discourse as well, and in which the answer to those anxieties about and fears of Jewish survival has been to make the state this unconditional element of near reverence and worship, in the idea that state therefore safeguards Jewish people, irrespective of what impact it has on Palestinians, right? And I think this is disastrous. It's disastrous for Palestinians. I also think it's actually dangerous for Jews as well, because I think states that impose tremendous amounts of violence on other people ultimately endanger everybody.
Right. How would you connect secularization with politicalization, right? The ways in which once we pivot away from the religious basis of so much of what holds us together and start dehumanizing people, it leads to a secularization that becomes ripe for political opportunists.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. Today, we tend to imagine that oftentimes that it's the forces of religiously observant Jews, Orthodox Jews, who are pushing Israel in this kind of right-wing direction. But if you look at the history of Jewish debates about Zionism, oftentimes you find in earlier parts of the 20th century that Jewish religious authorities see nationalism as threatening because it's secular and actually as contrary to Jewish tradition because secular nationalism is alien to Jewish tradition. And I think one of the ways that this secularization has played itself out is that oftentimes, traditional notions of Jewish suffering in Jewish texts are connected to sinfulness, right? And so you look at traditional interpretations of something like the destruction of the temples. The focus is, even though the actions of the Second Temple was destroyed by the Romans, the focus is on what was the Jewish sin that led God to punish Jews in this way. And this has been a very kind of classic way for Jews to think in religious terms about bad things that happened to Jews. The question is, why is God punishing us? What did we do wrong? Now, for modern, more secular people, this is not an easy way to think, right? If you take it in its most extreme form, there were Jewish religious authorities who asked this question about the Holocaust, right? But most Jews found that question to be obscene, to say that we should be to blame for the Nazi genocide against the Jews. And so I think in some ways, because this language of sinfulness is more uncomfortable for people today, perhaps for some good reasons, the story that has eclipsed it is this Jewish story is essentially that we are fated to be these kind of permanent and righteous victims in the world. And that is always the position we occupy in every story. And I think it's that effort to put Israel and Palestine within that template that leads to so much misunderstanding of Palestinians and indeed so much dehumanization of Palestinians, because Palestinians essentially get imagined as simply the reincarnation of these figures of oppression from Jewish sacred texts and Jewish history, whether it's Amalek, as Netanyahu invoked from the Bible, or Hitler, or whatever else.
I was just thinking about, as you were speaking, this wonderful book by Stephen Charleston called We Survived the End of the World, Lessons from Native America and on Apocalypse and Hope. And it's a wonderful book because he looks at four different Native American prophets. And one of them talks about how in one of their teachings, he does this interesting shift from, we always think about indigenous people as strongly collective, but he said at this particular point in history, this prophet believed that it was important to understand the responsibility that individuals might have in their own fate. And so I think you talk in your book too about the idea of Jewish innocence, and this innocence is a kind of cover for an evasion of responsibility in some ways. Could you talk a little bit about that, about the idea of responsibility?
Yeah, I think that part of seeing ourselves as fully human is recognizing that we have the same capacity as all other human beings for the full range of human behavior. Absolutely. I don't think that most Jewish leaders would say that's wrong, but in the way that they actually talk about Israel and Jewish behavior, I think they actually behave as if they can't conceive, right? Even if you look at this question of this term genocide, which has now become so controversial in recent years that Amnesty International suggested that, now again, one could look carefully at the international legal definition of genocide, look at what we know about what Israel has done in Gaza, look at other examples where genocide has been applied, and then try to make some kind of argument. But the thrust, I think, of pro-Israel discourse is essentially to say a priori, that because Israel is a democratic state, because it's a virtuous state, and indeed that because it's our state as Jews, it's incapable of this, right? This is something that China could do to the Uyghurs or Sudan could do in Darfur, but we are not capable of that. I think that's, to me, this a kind of an exceptionalist discourse that runs throughout a lot of mainstream Jewish conversation about Israel. And you know, that essentially, and it also runs throughout American discourse about America's allies, right? That kind of America's allies, even if they make mistakes, they must be in some fundamental way benevolent that makes them fundamentally different than these malevolent adversaries, right? But if you compare the horrors that Russia has committed in Ukraine to what Israel has done in Gaza, and you put aside the question of Israel as a Jewish state or a state that's an American ally, and simply look at the number of children who have been killed, for instance, right? You find that the number in Gaza is far higher, even though the population is much smaller and the war has been going on since October 7th. It's been a shorter period of time. So I think that it's important for us to try to get outside of these exceptionalist frameworks and realize that Jews as a group of people and Israel as a state are capable of any of the same kinds of horrors that any other group of people in any other state are capable of.
Well, that's so powerful. And this is might seem counterintuitive, but as you were speaking, I was thinking that maybe not being innocent and taking responsibility is liberating. Uh-huh. Right? It makes you more fully human. And if you can accept that in yourself, you can accept that in other people, and we can start getting someplace rather than making these clean breaks between absolute responsibility or absolute innocence. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the weaponization or the selective application of the notion of anti-Semitism. And of course, just recently we had Elon Musk making that gesture and the ADL exceptionalizing in some ways.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about how that works within this?
You know? Sure. What's, I think, unusual about what's happened to the organized American Jewish community, and this is true for other diaspora Jewish communities as well, really since the 1970s, is that the fight against bigotry against Jews has become deeply embedded in the defense of a state. And so the two things are actually conflated. So that this was the term that was used for this in the 1970s was the new anti-Semitism, which the claim was that there was a new form of anti-Semitism, now stronger on the left, which instead of targeting individual Jews, it targets the Jewish state, makes it a kind of stand-in for individual Jews. So the phrase that often gets used is that Israel is the Jew of the nation. The problem with this formulation, though, is that states are self-interested actors, right? And states are not representations of individual people of a particular group. And if you see attacks on the policies or even legitimacy of a state as equivalent to bigoted attacks on individuals from a group of people, right? You end up in some very strange places. It would be almost the equivalent of saying you're an anti-Black racist if you have a profound critique of the state of Nigeria or of Kenya, right? Or you're an anti-Asian racist if you question the legitimacy of the People's Republic of China, or an anti-Muslim bigot if you question oppression in Saudi Arabia. This doesn't make any sense. And so what happens is, because the standard for what constitutes anti-Semitism becomes then, in large measure, how you treat the state of Israel. If you support the state of Israel, then you actually get this kind of credit, right? It means that you can often get a pass on the way you actually treat individual Jews, right? Yeah. And it's particularly perverse because one often finds in America, and not just America, in Europe as well, that some of the people who have the most negative views of Jews in their own countries have extremely positive views of Israel, right? Which allows them a kind of protection against the charge of anti-Semitism, because within the mainstream Jewish discourse, if you're pro-Israel, therefore you can't really be anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
But you very much can, because many of the people who like Israel so much because they believe that every state should be basically dominated by one tribe, and they believe that Jews are a tribe that should dominate Israel, right? But if Jews are going to live somewhere else, like the United States or France or Hungary, then Jews should know their place. It's not really our country. That's not actually an intellectually coherent position. It's actually quite a coherent ethno-nationalist position, right? Now argued, whether it's Elon Musk's position or a lot of other people in the Trump administration. And yet the ADL can't recognize this for what it is, which is pro-Israel, Zionist, and anti-Semitic at the same time.
Yeah. No, that's a wonderful response and explanation. I was thinking also, it helps us understand even better how dangerous it is to have that distraction, because we're taking our eyes off exactly the most virulent forms of anti-Semitism, and we're caught up in this sort of trap of second guessing and interpreting and things like that. I want to ask you what you think the main criticism of your book will be, because it is emphatic and powerful, and it says things that will disturb a lot of people in many different ways.
Yeah. I think there are different kinds of critiques. I think there's a critique, you'd say, from the left, which might go along and say something like, why are we having a conversation about Jewish identity in the midst of this overwhelming Palestinian suffering, right? That already Palestinians are marginalized in these conversations, that Palestinian lives and perspectives are not considered equal. Here we have this new book coming in, and basically people be talking more about Jews. Maybe we should talk less about Jews and center Palestinians for a change. I think that's a very legitimate critique. I think my response to it would be that Palestinian liberation requires a political shift, and part of that political shift has to be some shift within Jewish politics, and that it's that shift within Jewish politics that I believe is my best way of playing some small role in a struggle for Palestinian liberation. So I don't see the two as at odds with one another. There would be another set of critiques which basically say that my vision is essentially naive, because that the relations between Israeli Jews and Palestinians are much more zero-sum than I'm acknowledging, and that in Hamas, you have a political movement that doesn't have a vision of equality under the law in one secular state, but imagines an Islamic state. And its ideology, if ever to gain power over Israeli Jews, would be profoundly dangerous for Israeli Jews, and that the hard shell of a state in which Jews rule is what protects Jews in Israel from that, and even perhaps what protects Jews around the world by giving them this as a safe haven. And I spend a fair amount of time in my book in various ways trying to argue against that position. My basic argument would be that Hamas has an ideology that I very profoundly disagree with, but I don't think fundamentally Israel has a Hamas problem. It has a Palestinian problem, that Palestinians were resisting Israel and Zionism since long before Hamas was created. In fact, one of the reasons that Israel was fairly sympathetic to Hamas in its early days in the late 1980s was because they couldn't imagine any Palestinian group that would be more hostile to Israel than the PLO and the PFLP and these nationalist and leftist groups, right? So that if Hamas were to cease to exist, I don't know a single Palestinian who believes that if Hamas ceased to exist, the Palestinians would stop fighting against Israel. It seems to me the critical question that we should think about is, how can we intervene in ways that show that Palestinian resistance that is more ethical can be more successful. So it weakens the forces in Palestinian politics who want to use violence that I think is unethical because it targets civilians. And as I argue in the book, I just fundamentally believe states tend to be less violent when all groups in a divided society have a voice in government, because people tend to turn to armed resistance when they have no way nonviolently of getting the state to meet their needs. So that would be the crux of my response to that critique.
Yeah, I was really struck by and appreciated your reference to struggles in other parts of the world, the United States, civil rights movement, Ireland, and of course, South Africa. And you write very passionately about your own experience of learning as a South African. Could you talk more about that? Because your last comments led us to this point very nicely.
Thanks. Yeah. So my parents immigrated from South Africa just before I was born. And I spent a fair amount of time in South Africa when I was a child. And I'm grateful for that experience. First of all, because I think that very often in many Jewish families, the way in which our family histories are narrated is just family histories of oppression and then kind of survival and success in the United States or wherever. But I think I got to see a Jewish community that I felt very connected to and part of that was actually benefiting from a system of supremacy. It was a system of white supremacy, but most Jews were considered white. And so I saw Jews, like other white South Africans, rationalizing this system of supremacy. And in many ways, the rationalizations sound, you know, very familiar to me. When I think about them, they're not so different than the kind of rationalizations of Jewish supremacy one hears today. We tend, in retrospect, to sanitize these things and to think, how could anyone in white South Africa have been afraid? White South Africans were only 10% of the population. Jews are 50% in Israel-Palestine. They were much more isolated internationally than were Jews. They didn't have as powerful a transnational diaspora. And when they looked at the African continent, they did not see that post-colonial African states had been these flourishing liberal democracies. Just like Jews frequently say, where are the liberal democracies in the Arab world? Why would you think that a democratic Israel-Palestine could ever survive as a liberal democracy where Jews could be safe? That's very similar to what white South Africans said when they looked at Congo and Nigeria and Zimbabwe. The ANC, Nelson Mandela's organization, was not nonviolent. They used armed resistance. They were classified as a terrorist organization by the United States. They were backed by the Soviet Union. The PAC, the ANC's rival, had this informal slogan of one settler, one bullet, which was pretty frightening to a lot of white South Africans. So the point that I wanted to try to make by invoking South Africa and also the U.S. and Northern Ireland is that I think many Jews tend to think that our existential fears that the end of Jewish supremacy would mean Jewish death. We often think that's the product of our traumatic history. It is informed by our traumatic history, but I also think it's commonplace among groups of people who become accustomed to supremacy to believe that equality means death. This was a kind of staple of white discourse during the period of slavery and segregation, that basically either white people would be on top or black people would be on top. And I quote in the book Ian Paisley, the Protestant leader in Northern Ireland, who says on the eve of the Good Friday Agreement, which gives Catholics political equality, he calls it a prelude to genocide, right? So this discourse is actually very familiar. And so I think if we can step outside of our own experience and ask the question, why were those other groups wrong? Why didn't things play out that way? It may help give us a different window into the conditions in Israel and Palestine and the potential future.
A lot of what you talk about in that regard is giving people rights, giving them a voice and a sense of agency. And maybe I'm being hopelessly idealistic. I don't think people are inherently, I don't think that this is something that necessarily has to happen. I think people resort to that when they're cornered, when they have absolutely no other choice, and when they have a long history of being denied that choice, that they seek any means to relieve that suffering, which is natural. And so what you're saying is that it's proven over and over again that a military violent solution is not going to get us out of this. What do you think about the current ceasefire agreement? I know it's very early to make anything clear, but what are your initial thoughts?
Thank goodness some are being released. The obligation to release hostages or captives is very deep in Jewish tradition. It says in the Talmud that you can sell the beams of a synagogue to raise the money to redeem a captive. One of the ways in which God is described in Jewish morning prayers is that he who, or the entity that redeems captives. So I think that's very important. And I was very grateful to see that now these three women were released from captivity. And I'm also very grateful to see that for at least for a moment, there's a respite in Gaza from the dropping of bombs and that some more humanitarian aid can come in, and that some Palestinian prisoners who were put in jail without any due process also can return to their families. But my fear is that the ceasefire will not hold past the first initial 6 weeks. First of all, because it might bring down Benjamin Netanyahu's government if it did. And secondly, because there's really no political vision for what happens after the war. Netanyahu and the government have not been willing to essentially contemplate any real discussion about who rules Gaza after this. The only people in Israel, really in Israeli politics, who have in government, who have a coherent vision are the people on the right, whose vision is basically the expulsion of Palestinians and the resettlement of Gaza. And Netanyahu has not offered any alternative to that. So in a way, he's become complicit in that vision. And so that's my fear, is that this will be seen as a respite, but it would take enormous U.S. and international pressure to create a situation in which Israel was willing to be open to allowing Gaza to reconstruct. It's one thing to bring in some more tents and give people a little bit more food for a while, but the entire of the Gaza Strip has to be rebuilt, right? And all of the evidence suggests that Israel is going to tighten the blockade, has tightened, and will continue to keep a tighter blockade than existed before October 7th, right? And even before October 7th, the United Nations had said Gaza was essentially unlivable for human beings because of the effects of this blockade.
That sort of aligns with what my suspicions are. So my last question to you is that your book actually begins with a section entitled "A Note to My Former Friend." I imagine a lot of American Jews will be skeptical about your arguments. And of course, many will never change their minds. I would like to ask you, what would you say to those who would, not to convince them necessarily, but to give you a fair hearing?
Yeah, I try to write the book in a way to try to increase the possibility that people who disagree with me might be willing to read the book. And so I tried to think carefully about the way I use language, and also to try to respond explicitly to the arguments that I hear from people on the other side, because I think there's no possibility at all that you can convince somebody unless you acknowledge the perspective that they have and then try to respond to it. What I've noticed over the years is the thing that has the much greater impact in changing people's opinions and changing their hearts than anything that I say are actually human interactions with Palestinians. That it is that there is a dehumanization that I think is just so pervasive in mainstream Jewish discourse about Palestinians that in some way it's very difficult to counter it until one has a human experience with Palestinians. And then one realizes, wow, this person doesn't conform to all of these stereotypes that I've been carrying around in my head. They don't seem to have any inherent desire to kill Jews. They don't seem to have any less love of life. And it almost sounds, these things are so obvious to say, but I think in some ways this experience of this is a common thing that happens when you have to justify supremacist political systems is that basically you end up dehumanizing people on the other side and imagining that those people could not be trusted with rights in the way that you can be trusted. And so I think the shift that would be most transformative in the organized American Jewish community would be if it became normal for synagogues and other Jewish institutions to allow Palestinians to come and speak about their own experience. Because so often there's this speaking about Palestinians, but not listening to them. So maybe my book might make some readers be more willing to engage in that process.
And I was also thinking, as you were speaking, about the importance of universities. Universities are very interested in managing things.
Yeah.
And
yes.
Students have, with our encampment here and other events, managed to have really good conversations outside of the official mandates, just in interacting with people, because they have an interest in learning when they're not polarized.
No, I think this is exactly right. So often in the organized Jewish community, the discourse about universities is one that focuses on the idea that Jewish students are unsafe and Jewish students are threatened. And there have been incidents of anti-Semitism on campus, of course. But a lot of what's actually happening, I think, is there is a kind of discomfort among some Jewish students who come from pro-Israel environments and then are encountering students or even faculty who are exposing them to a very different set of ideas and experiences. And I actually think that this is what universities are supposed to do, is supposed to make students feel uncomfortable, not threatened, not harmed or intimidated or harassed, God forbid, but to have an experience of intellectual, even moral discomfort. And I think what the organized American Jewish community tends not to notice or not want to acknowledge is that actually, not infrequently from that period experience of discomfort, actually Jewish students rethink things and are more open and awaken, often more than their parents are, to learning from Palestinians, that there's a lot of learning that takes place, and that I have seen again and again the way in which you find Jewish students who change their minds when they're on college campuses in quite dramatic ways and start to think about what it means to be Jewish and be in solidarity with Palestinian freedom. And I think this is exactly what universities are supposed to be doing. And yet this is part of the reason that universities are now under attack.
Yeah. And before we began recording, talking about the anti-Semitism decision at Harvard to accept the definition of and to declare Zionism a protected category. So these kinds of things.
It's astonishing. The International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance of definition of anti-Semitism has very little support among scholars of anti-Semitism, among Jews who study, mostly Jewish scholars who study Holocaust and anti-Semitism and study Jewish history. It's basically pushed by bureaucrats and Jewish political organizations and politicians. There are competing definitions like the Jerusalem Declaration that have far more support. So if Harvard had just consulted its own scholars who study these questions, there's zero chance it would have adopted the IHRA definition. It's such a profoundly anti-scholarly decision to basically adopt this to appease politicians and Jewish organizations. And basically, it's a slap in the face to your own scholars who study these subjects.
Yes. I can't help but ask one more question, which is, what gives you hope? I think with the world that we have today, and it can be as big a hope or as small a hope as you want, but just whatever you can share.
I think, first of all, it's that often systems of oppression that seem indestructible at one moment in time turn out not to be indestructible. I grew up in the 1980s. There were late into the 1980s, very few people who imagined that Eastern Europe would no longer be under Soviet domination or who imagined that apartheid would end. And yet, I think there were very few Americans as late as the 1940s who could have imagined, or even the 50s could have imagined, a U.S. military where it was routine for white soldiers to take orders from black officers. And yet these things happened because of movements that made them happen and changes in geopolitical dynamics. And so that's one. And I think that there is the possibility, we have no idea, but there is the possibility that this movement for Palestinian freedom could be one of those movements that develops the power to change, even overcome entrenched political forces. I think it is a movement based around basic ideas of human dignity and human equality. And we've seen in the last couple of years the way in which it is able to attract people from all different backgrounds around this vision. And I think that I see signs of hope among younger American Jews who want to become part of this movement, even when it often costs them something in terms of their relationships with their communities and their families. And I think that's inspiring to me.
That's a wonderful note to end on. Thank you so much for spending time with us. And thank you so much for this marvelous book.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Take care and thank you again.
All right. Sounds good. Take care.
Bye-bye.